You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and I can't believe that 2024 marks 10 years of podcasting. Over the last decade, I have had the pleasure of talking with hundreds upon hundreds of passionate outdoors men and women who share the same excitement for hunting as I do. Whether you hunt public lands or private property, shoot traditional archery equipment or high-powered rifles, we all have one thing in common. And that's our love for the great outdoors. This year, I plan on continuing that tradition and bringing educational and entertaining content to your ears. Thank you for your continued support, and I hope you all have the best seasons of your life. Good vibes in, good vibes out. Ladies and gentlemen, here we go. Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today is the annual wild turkey episode that I do or have been doing. I don't do a lot of turkey content, mainly because it's just not a priority of mine, right? I know I love turkey hunting. I'm very excited about the next couple weeks where I'm going to be taking my son and daughter out. My daughter, I just bought a brand new 410 for her, and a Stevens, I believe. That's a spinoff of a Savage, Savage Arms. But I bought her a 410. The 20 gauge single shot that we have just kicked a little bit too much for her at this time. And so I got the 410 with a turkey choke on it, and we're going to go out and shoot it here, oh, this week sometime, hoping to get her comfortable with it. And I doubt it kicks that much, but get her comfortable with that. And then we're going to go turkey hunting during the Iowa youth season here. And so I'm really looking forward to that. Today's episode is with Mark Hatfield. And I'm going to pull up real quick what he is. He is the Director of Science and Planning, the National Director of Science and Planning. So projects, you know, he has research oversight. He does projects. He helps guides the NWTF mission. And in this episode, he goes into detail about some of the research projects that he's done in the past and how he works with federal and state agencies on, you know, that to help manage the wild turkey population in North America. And so it's a really good episode, very insightful, very educational, and it just gives you an idea of what turkeys go through in a given year, specifically males. We talk about why do, you know, simple questions like why do turkeys strut? What is a turkey's diet? So not only do we talk about projects, but we also talk about biology and what a wild turkey is doing throughout the course of its lifetime. So that's it. That's what today's episode is about. Let's get into the commercials. And I really do appreciate you guys taking time out of your day to listen, right? And so when I do my commercials here, I would also appreciate it if you could stop, listen, and go investigate some of these companies, go to their websites. If you're looking for a saddle hunting accessories, these guys also have a turkey hunting vest that is pretty darn sweet. And you can go to tetherednation.com to go check that out. On top of their saddle hunting equipment, platforms, climbing sticks, you name it, they have it. Go check out their turkey hunting vest as well. Tethered does a really good job, and I believe they work really closely with the hunting public to get that created and put together. Go visit tetherednation.com. WaspArchery.com just signed another contract with them for another year, and I believe that makes them the longest running partner of the Nine Finger Chronicles. And I an amazing company, amazing people. Most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States, which is, it's important to me, right? Now, I'm not saying all products that I buy are made in America, but when a company puts in the effort to manufacture their goods in the United States, that means something, right? It means that they care about America. And so, and on top of that, they have awesome material, awesome design. And when you put a wasp broadhead in the sweet spot, the blood trail is absolutely amazing. It does tons of damage, and it makes recovering your deer or elk or mule deer, whatever you shoot it, you know, that broadhead with, it does a really good job. So go to wasparchery.com, enter the discount code NFC20 for 20% off your purchase. Go stock up today. Next on the list, another company that supplies turkey hunting gear and equipment, and specifically Red Dots Optics. So obviously they have range finders, they have binoculars, they have spotting scopes, but they also have a lineup of red dots for your shotgun or your pistol. And I'm looking to pick up the Crossfire, I believe it is. It's a red dot for my daughter's 410, which will make aiming for her just a little bit easier. So vortexoptics.com. Go to, if you're looking to make a purchase, go to eurooptic.com and enter the discount code number 9, the word finger, and then 10. So 9 finger 10, and that's going to save you 10% at eurooptic.com on all of Vortex products that they carry. Next on the list, Code Blue Sense, another company that I just re-upped with, and these guys are doing great things in the scent game, in the scent elimination game. I am really looking forward to my Rope-A-Dope kit, getting more of those in, going and setting those up, and really creating, I don't want to say traps, but creating destinations for deer to come investigate, specifically bucks around that pre-rut time frame when they're on their feet, they're checking doe groups, and they're going through specific terrain features to get from certain places. And I want a Rope-A-Dope right there with me, or right in that area within shooting range. And when a big deer, you put these places out long enough, deer are going to come investigate, and they're going to stop by, they're going to sniff around, they're going to stop and slow down, and hopefully one of those is a big deer that you can, that we can, you know, put an arrow through. So really looking forward to that. CodeBlueSense.com, discount code NFC20. Take a look at all of their synthetic and real deer urine, scent elimination, the Rope-A-Dope kit, you name it, they got it. Next on the list is Woodman's Pal. The Woodman's Pal has been around since the 1940s. If you don't know what that is, the Woodman's Pal is a machete, a habitat tool that allows you, you know, you put it on your hip, you can put it in your backpack. I keep one in my truck. And anytime you go to check trail cameras or do your preseason work where you're maybe some grass grew up in front of your trail camera or a shooting lane, or you need to hack a access route, the Woodman's Pal is perfect for that. Another made in America company. Go to woodmanspal.com, check it out, along with all of their other leather goods that they offer as well. Next on the list is Huntworth. In my opinion, Huntworth has some of the best, if not the best, system. And what I mean by that is they don't necessarily have it laid out to where you should get this, you should get this, you should get this. They have a setup or a list of clothing, whether it's early and it's warm, it's one of those days where it's cold in the morning but then hot in the afternoon, or your late season where they also have the heat boost technology that goes into all of their clothing. But what I'm getting at is Huntworth really offers a lineup and options that you can make your own very specific to you layering system, and with their base layers and things like that. All starts with their base layers, and their base layers are amazing. So go to huntworthgear.com, and I don't think there's a discount code right now out, but if you follow them on social media, and every once in a while they'll send me a discount code, and I will, if you follow me on Instagram, I'll make sure you guys get that. Huntworth, and then obviously huntworthgear.com, go check that out. Last but not least, my own brand, and that is Full Sneak Gear. I had to think a second. Full Sneak Gear. If you guys haven't been to fullsneakgear.com, do me a favor, go check it out. It's affordable, but it's also very high quality. I have tons of t-shirts in stock. I just got an order in. The first round pretty much sold out, and the second round is here for you to buy. So go to fullsneakgear.com, check it out. Other than that, please go to iTunes, leave a 5-star review, go to Instagram, follow me, and comment, right? I love the interaction between all of you and myself, whether that is, hey Dan, take a look at my farm, to hey Dan, what do you think about this or that, or this product or this strategy? I love to BS just like everybody else. And so hit me up if you have any questions, or you have a kick-ass story and you want to be a guest on the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, hit me up. Other than that, let's get into today's National Wild Turkey Federation episode with Mark Hatfield. Enjoy. 3, 2, 1. All right, everybody, welcome to the annual turkey hunting episode that I do. I don't do very many turkey hunting episodes, but I think that's going to change, because every year I get a little bit more excited about turkey hunting. And I thought today would be a good day to talk with Mark Hatfield from the NWTF about wild turkey. Mark, how are we doing today?
I'm doing good, man. Here in South Carolina, we're locked and loaded, ready for spring. So pretty exciting time.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you kick off this episode with what you do, what your title and role is within the NWTF?
Yeah, so first of all, thanks for having me on the show, and looking forward to the conversation this morning. But as you said, my name is Mark Hatfield. I'm the National Director of Science and Planning for the National Wild Turkey Federation. And I've been with NWTF for about 20 years now, getting ready to cross over my 20-year anniversary. And my role here is to really help guide and drive the investments into the mission of the organization. But also, I oversee the research component of NWTF and our research investments. And I work directly with the state wildlife agencies on what's called the NWTF Technical Committee, which is comprised of every turkey biologist across every state, works with us and serves as an advisory board for the NWTF. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of provide strategic oversight for where we're going as an organization, where we're investing dollars in the mission.
Gotcha. Okay. And I do have to ask, were you part of the Hatfield and McCoy rivalry back in the day? Do you have ties to that at all?
So I am from Kentucky originally.
Okay.
And so, of course, fairly close. My family says I am, but they can't prove it. So I'm just going to say yes, we can go from there. But I grew up in Kentucky, really in the central part of Kentucky, right around the Bardstown, Elizabethtown area, where I grew up turkey hunting, deer hunting, and ended up going to school in Western Kentucky. So I've got strong Kentucky ties, but I've been in South Carolina for 20 years. But My wife never knew how many times I got asked that question until her name became Hatfield. And now whenever she goes to the airport, people ask her. So.
That's crazy. That's crazy. All right. Let's talk a little bit about your role. And, you know, that title makes it sound like you do a lot of research. You know, whether it's biology, whether it's, you know, maybe patterning of how they move throughout the year, the environment that they live in. So within a given year, what do you do?
So, you know, we kicked the year off in organizing our NWTF convention that we just capped off here a couple weeks ago, 72,000 turkey enthusiasts in Nashville. And so I worked there prior to leading up to that. I worked with our technical committee. I worked with the state agency directors, our federal agency partners, and convene them in Nashville at our convention to talk about what we need to be doing, how we need to be investing, what priorities we have as an organization so we can leverage our dollars to go further on the ground.
Okay.
Coming out of that, I am hitting the ground running. We're working through a request for proposals to solicit research projects where we will allocate funding into that.
Okay.
And then that'll be launched here probably about the 1st of April. And then we will solicit projects. We will then score and rank those projects based on best fit, application, management needs. And then that gets awarded in midsummer. And then from that standpoint, I'm working with our conservation staff, foresters, biologists to build contracts, agreements, so we can leverage dollars on the ground. So a lot of it is, I used to be the biologist that was jumping out of helicopters and trapping animals and all this stuff. And now I'm working on kind of convening groups and convening our staff to deliver mission in really efficient ways.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Talk to us about some of the cool projects that you've worked on throughout the years and maybe some of the details behind why you were doing that study or that project.
Yeah. So one of those, and probably something that's starting to get lost because it was about 15 years ago, but it was still a really cool project is I went down to Mexico and I trapped Gould's wild turkeys in central Mexico and helped transport those back across the international border. And we then restocked those birds into southeastern Arizona.
Oh, okay.
And so the population that we have in southeast Arizona and southwest New Mexico were sourced from Mexico. And so that was able to reestablish that population. And now there's limited number of tags, but we were able to at least add that to, you know, a huntable population within the U.S. You know, other projects we've been doing is been working with the U.S. Forest Service on what's called the Wildfire Crisis Strategy, where we're trying to improve forest health, mitigate for massive wildfires in the West, while also trying to support local infrastructure, such as mills, lumber yards, lumber companies, to ensure that we have the ability to manage forests moving forward. So
yeah.
People don't see us as that way, but man, we completed about 1 million acres on the ground last year.
Oh, wow.
So when you think about our scope and scale, where we're at, what we're doing, man, we try to be pretty nimble in our approaches.
Yeah. Yeah. And what usually comes out, like what's the mission or the goal on these projects?
Yeah. So let's just talk about research.
Okay.
Research is going to be, we've always invested in wild turkey research. In our history, we've invested about $9.5 million into wild turkey research. NWTF raised money. And so we then leverage that with partners, state agencies, universities. But what we're investing in research is we're trying to make sure we have the best information available to the state wildlife management agency biologists, so they can impose and really manage the bird to the greatest ability for us to maximize the opportunities. Mm-hmm. So we want to maximize hunting opportunities across the country, but we want to do so that's really grounded in science and research and information to ensure that we're not, we're not too liberal with those regulations, because state agencies have to manage these birds for everybody.
Right.
So what we end up doing is we end up doing funding 2, 3, 4 year projects that are supported by the state agencies to address the questions that they may have so they can better manage birds. So if we do a three-year project, that three-year project's going to run for 3 years. It's then going to be distilled into some management recommendations, and it's going to be shared out amongst all the state wildlife agency biologists that are infused with turkeys,
right?
And that's in their portfolio to make sure that we're doing that. Let me turn my phone off here so I can talk.
So how do you guys determine what project to do? I mean, do you guys just have like a creative where you're just like spitballing ideas back and forth to each other, and then that goes to a committee, and that committee says, hey, yes on this or no on that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So what we end up doing is we are connected with the Regional Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. They have turkey biologist meetings. We're involved with those. We have the NWTF Technical Committee. And between the conversations between our staff, organizationally, our priorities, between the priorities set forth by those groups, we kind of distill that into some topics that we want to address. And then we solicit projects that help address those questions.
Yeah.
Some of them may be adult and poult mortality causes. One may be the effects of wildlife disease on turkey population levels and potential reproduction rates that are going on. Another one may be looking at habitat manipulation needs and the response to turkey populations based on those management practices.
Okay.
So we throw those questions out. We then say, man, you guys are the best minds. You all figure out the best way to do this, and you bring something back to us as the NWTF. And then we farm those back out to our staff and to the technical committee, the state agency biologists, and then they rank those and say, man, this project is the best one. This one needs a little bit of work. And then we just work back through our budget and we fund the most appropriate ones based on that scoring of the state agencies. So what that does is it'll make sure that we're funding research that the agencies need.
Gotcha.
You know, and we're connected with them, because what we don't want to do is fund research and it sits on the shelf. We want it to be funded. We want the information to be used. And then we want people to trust that information, that it's done in a very, very rigorous manner.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So how closely obviously you work with state agencies in some way, shape, or form. Are you doing that at the federal level as well?
We do so, but that is more on the habitat side of things.
Okay.
Than we do with the states and research. Now, we work habitat work investments into the wild, you know, state wildlife agencies, but we just do habitat work on the federal agency lands.
Yeah.
Forest Service. We do some work with the Fish and Wildlife Service. We've done some work with Bureau of Land Management. And then we also work with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, which is a private lands, a technical assistance agency that provides cost share money, financial assistance money to private landowners to do work on their private land. So we try to address it in that manner as well.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So let's talk about, I'm trying to think, do I want to talk about the turkey themselves or the habitat? Let's start with habitat, right? And the wild turkey, I mean, from Merriam's to Eastern's to, you know, the Osceola?
Osceola. I say Osceola.
Okay, Osceola. All right. They live in a wide variety of habitats. Is there something that wild turkey need on the landscape in order to survive?
So the best way that I can describe that is they need disturbance. Okay. They need changing habitats. They need what's called early successional habitat. They need that to change and to be reestablished year over year over year, so it doesn't grow up into this unusable habitat. And they need a kind of a checkerboard layout of that type of habitat. So they need their habitat needs to change. It needs to be managed and it needs to have activity on it.
Activity. What is activity?
Here in the Southeast, it's prescribed burning.
Okay.
It's, you know, on a 2 to 3 year rotation. It's timber management. It's timber stand improvement, where you're going in and you're cutting out the undesirable trees for the desirable trees.
Yep.
Daylighting a road so you can widen the road edges so that you've got more sunlight going to the forest floor.
Okay.
And the edges. It is storms. You know, it's wind-blown oak trees that are getting blown over and creating sunlight, and it's creating this patchwork of accessible habitat. But it needs to be dispersed kind of across the landscape. You know, yeah. You don't want all your brooding habitat to be in one corner of your farm. Mm-hmm. You want that to be spaced out so it's available and accessible to turkeys. So when we first started the restoration of turkeys, people thought they needed old growth forests. Mm-hmm. Well, that's just where we found them, because we had already kind of hunted them to extinction at some point. And then through unregulated, you know, harvest management and, you know, timbering and all this other stuff, we pushed these birds into areas where they didn't really fit, but we hadn't cut their trees down yet. So they need trees is the other big piece of that. Disturbance, trees, and accessible habitat.
Gotcha. And then when you say trees, I hunt mule deer out in western South Dakota, and there are areas where I've seen turkeys, but I haven't seen a ton of trees, right? And so when it comes to roosting, do wild turkey roost every night?
Turkeys will roost every single night if they are not sitting on the nest.
Okay.
And so male birds, once they get to about 2 weeks old, and so before we jump into that, so think about this. So let's start at the nesting season or the breeding season. That's what we're in right now, and then we'll kind of take that full circle. So right now, wild turkeys are going through the process of starting to establish their kind of hierarchical structure within their flocks that they operate in. And so that is what we're seeing now. Even as far south as Florida, we've got birds that have already been harvested in Florida. Hunting seasons are going on. We're not too far from that in South Carolina. And then it progressively gets later the further north you go. But turkeys have to be, they're going to nest, they're going to be in the trees all season long until that hen has a full clutch of eggs on the ground. Okay. And at that point, that hen will stay on that nest for 27 to 29 days, 30 days, depending, you know, there's always a couple day variation. And so she's sitting on that nest. Once she starts incubating, she very rarely comes off of that nest throughout the entire nesting season. Once those birds are hatched, she's got about 2 weeks that she's on the ground with them, give or take a couple days. Mm-hmm. Until those birds have the ability to fly and they have their flight feathers that are coming in, and those birds can then get up into a tree. And at that point, those birds are going to be in a tree every single night for the rest of their life, unless they are a hen sitting on a nest.
Okay. All right. So you said 2 weeks after they're born, they can fly?
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Are what's called, yeah, I mean, it happens pretty quick, you know. Turkeys are what's called semi-precocial.
Okay.
You know, you may have heard the term, somebody's like, oh, that's a very precocial child, you know, or something along those lines. Well, semi-precocial means that they still rely on the mother or the hen to follow and to mimic her and to figure out what's going on, and she still provides some protection. When you're precocial, you're kind of all by yourself. You're hatched, you're born, and then you're done. You know, you just kind of go do your own thing. But turkeys are semi-precocial. They still need some help, but they're not the bluebirds or the migratory birds that are completely featherless when they're hatched in a nest, you know, that you find on your front porch from a wren or house finch or something along those lines.
Yeah. Okay.
And so they can fly about 2 weeks. They start producing flight feathers, and they can get up off the ground, and then their survival goes up quite a bit from there.
Okay. What is the job of the mother at that point with the term here, semi-precocial? What does the mother just protect them, or is she doing what like a robin would do and collect food and feed them?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
She is not taking any food to those birds. She actually then starts to, once that nest is hatched, she then does she starts to look for food. They start following her.
Okay.
They mimic her. They try to eat what she's eating. So she's kind of this example for them. But then she also does protection. She will, you know, I've flushed a hen before with the colts, and she'll act like she's got a broken wing. Oh, and wow. She'll draw people away from, you know, the predators away from the colts. And then she will, you know, she tries to gather them together. You know, being a colt is hard work. Mm-hmm. You know, not many survive, even in an ideal situation. And so it's a tough thing being a turkey because everything likes to eat them, including us.
Yeah. And then how, from the time they hatch, how long until they're on their feet walking around with their mom?
Oh, I mean, they're all going to be hatching simultaneously. And so they will be at the nest site for a very limited amount of time. And then they're up following that bird around.
Gotcha.
And that's why it's the hen around. That's why it's so important to have accessible habitat for these birds.
Because what's a good nesting site?
It varies. And I would say out of all the research we've done, it's really hard to know exactly what the birds are looking for. Right. But we do know that you need to have a combination of horizontal structure. So if you're a predator and you're looking, you want something that's kind of broken up, right? That is just not a clear open space. Mm-hmm. You want some vertical structure because you want to be able to have some, you know, to be camouflaged and to be hidden from any avian predators. And so, but you also want that habitat that's got the vertical and horizontal structure to be kind of constant, right? You need that to be kind of everywhere because it makes it harder for any predators to find or to stumble across these birds sitting on the nests.
Gotcha.
So, but then after they're hatching, those little poults, I mean, they're not very big. I mean, they're the size of a coffee cup. They're walking.
Gotcha.
And they're walking. And so they need to be able to get through. They need bare ground. They need to be able to run and find clumps and hide. So it's a, you know, old fence rows, you know, I know you said you were in Iowa, you know, the edges of fields between agricultural fields and woods mm-hmm. is really good because it's typically a little vegetation in there, some trees mixed, you know, that are 5 to 6 feet tall. You probably get some sumac and some persimmons through there, probably some oak trees. And then that, but it never really progresses out of that. Then you get kind of some taller grasses in there that are clump grass. And those birds can kind of migrate and work their way through there.
Gotcha. Okay. From a habitat standpoint, removal of, or I don't know, like just people getting rid of certain type. Because, you know, here in Iowa, they farm. There's certain places where they farm right up to the edge. And they spray mm-hmm. everything and ditches. And, you know, and that's that was a threat to the pheasant population here, another ground mm-hmm. nesting animal. And so when it comes to habitat destruction, what type of habitat destruction has the biggest impact on the wild turkey?
Oh, well, I think that's going to be pretty variable where you're at in the country. You know, Osceolas, Easterns, Rios, Merriams, and Goulds, they all have a little different, I guess, search image for what the best habitat is. But let's deal with Easterns since that's kind of where you're at there mm-hmm. in Iowa. Is, you know, farming is a critical need for the country, for us. You know, Iowa's, you know, you fly over and you see the black soil and Illinois, and that just that area there is just so critical for us to make sure we have food, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're farming all the way up to the edge or maybe less marginal farmland, those are areas in which can be very productive for wild turkeys and other ground nesting birds, because you get that step down. You get the trees that are in the riparian areas, which are critical. Then it kind of steps down to the edge of that, and then it steps down even further to the agricultural. So it's important that we understand the steps of this, and then also the connectivity between those corridors as well. So here in the Southeast, you know, the lack of management or the lack of prescribed burning is probably the one thing that's going to be detrimental to wild turkeys moving forward, because you can manage a large number of acres for a pretty minimal cost, and you can do so in a pretty frequent manner. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to always have timber cuts and timber harvests, but that disturbance of going in and burning that understory, it opens it up and it creates those tracks and those pathways for those poults to be able to move and to live and to survive. But it also creates a good blanket of nesting habitat and brooding habitat, which makes it hard for predators to find those birds.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So when it comes to, I'll kick this next question off with a story. I had a buddy who shot a turkey and there was a snake in his stomach. It ate a snake, okay? And so I was like, well, what do wild turkey eat? And so that's the question. What is the diet of a wild turkey?
So that changes throughout the year. So let's just kind of start right now. The birds in my area right now are starting to really start to focus on the green up and the vegetation that we're starting to see around the state. You know, grasses, forbs, you know, the food plots that people put in the Southeast, the clovers are starting to kind of come on. They're looking for a vegetation because they've run out of the hard mast, right? Because the hard mast are the oak trees, you know, the acorns that are on the ground that these birds have survived on throughout the winter because it's persistent. Once that kind of transitions and we start to see this green up, they get buds, they get vegetations, they're going to get seeds. You know, they access a lot of agricultural farms as well, and will dig, you know, scratch up corn as well around here. But it's primarily a vegetative diet right now.
Okay.
Once they start to, you know, start to nest, because they want to come in there, they're eating hard mast acorns throughout the winter. They are going to a vegetation, kind of a green up diet right now. And then post hatching of these eggs, and they've got poults on the ground, they're looking for insects.
Okay.
They're looking for bugs. They're looking for grasshoppers, crickets, any bug, anything that's moving, they're going to look for because it's protein.
Gotcha.
Because we talked about poults producing flight feathers in 2 weeks. Those poults need energy. Mm-hmm. Those poults need, you know, bugs, they need grasshoppers, they need that protein. It's quick energy and a lot of it.
Gotcha.
And so that will then persist for a while to kind of get those birds out of that poult area, that poult age. And then they will start to have a mixture of insects and vegetation again. And then they will start to go back to the hard mass once acorns start falling, once hickory nuts start falling, you know, beech nuts, some of those, that's a little bit more of a soft mast tree, but they're looking for that. And then that'll persist them and take them through the winter. That's why you see some shifts in territories for turkeys, because they're following food sources.
Yeah. Gotcha. Just like whitetails, right? That different times of year have different diets. Now, is there something that they go and seek out?
That's a good question. You know, I think a lot of it would probably be based upon kind of what's in their immediate area.
Yeah.
You know, because if you have an area that's all oak hardwood bottoms and all you've got is the oak trees, but you don't have any of the bugging areas or the green up areas, those birds are going to shift. Mm-hmm. They're going to shift their patterns. So that's why it's important to have those bugging areas kind of throughout your farm, because those birds are going to be there, and it's closer proximity to this other hard mass. So these, think about it, the further these birds walk, the more susceptible they are to predation.
Right. Right.
You know, and so it, can you create an environment that has all four of their needs for their four seasons in an immediate area for these birds not to expose themselves to treks and moving poults a long distance and some of those things.
Gotcha. All right. All right. And so, I mean, so is a snake uncommon or a frog or something like that?
It's pretty uncommon. You know, I would say never say never, mm-hmm. you know, like you said with the story. But, yeah, I mean, they see it. They see it moving. You know, you're starting to see young of the year snakes coming out that time of year. They see it moving. They start chasing it. They eat it, you know, and they move on.
Gotcha.
You know, they do they seek it out? No. Would right. they take advantage of it? Yes.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about the males, because obviously we all want a big fat strutter to come down the lane and so we can shoot it. So talk to us a little bit about the cycle of life for a tom turkey.
Okay. So we're starting right before the winter flock right now. All these birds are kind of they're all together, right? The males are there, the females are there, the young of the year birds are there. They're kind of, this is where there's the least amount of competition going on amongst that group, right? They're not vying for, they're always vying for kind of position within the flock, but they're not really aggressive about it. You know, they're like, okay, whatever. But as the days start to get longer within just the photo period, just like as the photo period changes for whitetails, the photo period is very influential for turkeys and the reproductive ecology and process for wild turkeys. So as they start to get longer, these birds' hormones change. The males start to change, females start to, you know, start to be figuring out, okay, I got to start thinking about nesting, you know, and just, it's just the life cycle. But then you start to see this winter breakup. And what's occurring during that winter breakup is these birds are really starting to establish their hierarchical structure. These birds start to gobble a lot more. You start to see these birds strutting more, showing off. They're trying to be that high school kid mm-hmm. that's really starting to kind of come into their own. They want to show off that, you know, so they're trying to establish themselves as I'm the one in charge here.
Yeah.
And so then you get these satellite groups of bachelor groups that are of subordinate birds, such as Jake's, that may be grouped together because there's safety in numbers at that point, right? They're like, man, I'm not going to get beat up by this bully because there's three of us, but they know they're not going to go mess with the bully.
Yeah.
You know, that they're kind of safety in numbers. So they start gobbling, they go through this process, they have the winter breakup, then the hens start to have some nest initiation, and they get bred. They get bred multiple times, and then they will start to initiate their nest. And these birds are still creating this dominance. They're maintaining that pecking order throughout the entire spring season, mm-hmm. You know, nesting and breeding season. But then once those birds, the hens, go to nest, these males are then going, man, where did all the females go? So they start to show off again because they're trying to make sure that, you know, the natural tendency for turkeys are for the hens to go to the gobblers. Mm-hmm. Hunting has that reversed. The gobbler comes to the hen. So that's why it's really important. This is a little sidestep here. It's very important for us as hunters to understand the need to set seasons based on biological kind of timelines that turkeys create for us. We want seasons biologically set to where when hens start to go on the nest, start to break away from these males, the hens are all singles now, the males are all singles, the females are starting to break up and wander off. They're going to lay their egg, and they will lay an egg, one egg a day for 10 days on average, 10 to 12. And then as soon as that last egg is laid, they're sitting on that nest, and that gobbler's going, and where is everybody, right? So he starts gobbling again because he wants the males to come to him and the females to come to him. So that's kind of but it's important for us to have those seasons set so we can maximize the hunting opportunities when birds are gobbling the most and when they are out looking for hens versus the hens going to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Very.
And then,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's very interesting. And so, it sounds to me like there's a little bit of, you know, jockeying for position throughout the entire year. But when it comes to the breeding season, that's when you're going to find turkeys being the most aggressive.
Yeah, they're going to be the most aggressive because they are, you know, they're wired. They want to produce offspring. Mm-hmm. That's what the hens want to do. That's what the males want to do. That's how their fitness is defined biologically.
Mm-hmm.
But early part of the year, these birds are going to be gobbling. They're not going to really want to fight, but they're going to make sure that you know they're there. Then they're going to create this pecking order, and they establish it.
Yep.
And then the birds then get bred. Once they're bred, they go do the nest initiation, they incubate, and then these males that are out there where the females used to flock to them are going, all right, I'm going to be on the lookout now. I'm going to go find the females, and that's why they're receptive to our calling, and we can mimic the hen at that point as hunters. So, and then once the breeding cycle goes down and it's kind of done and the birds start to hatch, these males' testosterone level goes down, hormones changes go down, and then they just kind of start eating again because mm-hmm. most of them don't eat a whole lot during the breeding season. And then they will kind of fall back into these groups in the summer, and then they group back up in the fall and the winter, and then they do the cycle all over again. So it's a you know, that hierarchical structure is always there, but you get more flexibility the further you are away from the breeding cycle.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So I'm sitting in the timber, and I see a strutter out in the field with a couple hens, and he's full strut, and he's just circling around them all day long, mm-hmm. right? Let me just ask you this. Why does a tom turkey strut? What does it allow them to do? What is he showcasing?
He's showcasing he's more fit than the other ones that aren't strutting.
Mm-hmm.
He is demonstrating that I'm the one in charge. And again, I don't want to anthropomorphize the turkey. But he is saying, I've earned the right to be here and show off for you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's so the other ones are like, well, I'm not going to strut because he's going to beat me up. He's more fit than the other ones are.
Yeah.
And the hens will then be gravitated to go to that person, that turkey. And so he's earned that right. And so that's why he's strutting. He's showing off that I'm gobbling the most, I'm strutting, I'm out in the open, nobody's messing with me.
Gotcha.
Right? And so those hens are doing exactly what they should be doing. They're hanging out with the most fit gobbler
mm-hmm.
because they want to be bred, and then they will be bred, and then they will go lay their eggs.
Okay. So, I've been turkey hunting a long time now. You know, I started turkey hunting before I started deer hunting, and I can envision that, like a strutter coming through the woods with two other turkeys that want, maybe they're not in strut at all. They're toms. Maybe they're not in strut at all, or maybe they're in some kind of like a half strut, but never mm-hmm. like very rarely have I ever seen two or three toms come in because one of them is in charge. And is that an age thing, or is that like a behavior thing?
It's more behavioral. You know, they don't come in and say, oh, but the older bird that's more healthy coming out of the winter, you know, is going to be more fit and can mm-hmm. push these birds around. The younger birds are still trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, and so, we don't know exactly what goes into this hierarchical structure. But one thing we're starting to think through is what occurs when we harvest what we perceive as the dominant bird. It's not always we harvest the dominant bird and the next man up. You know, it's not, oh, next man up. And then, no, they have to reshuffle again because the dynamics change within their flock.
Yeah.
And so it's not always linear that way.
Yeah.
And so we don't know exactly how or what's being, but we know that they spend a lot of time to ensure that the most fit male are breeding with the most fit females.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of leads me to my next question. I've seen it with buffalo, right? A hunter shoots the dominant bull and then like chaos erupts.
Mm-hmm.
Or you've seen it on video where some guy shoots a turkey and all of a sudden, instead of run away, one tom will come over and start pecking the head and stomping on the other tom that just got shot. Why do they do that?
Well, why is always a difficult thing to explain, you know, but my perception of it is they see that their rival, something happened to him, and they're like, well, now's my chance. I can attack him, and I've got the upper hand now.
Yep.
And it's to restructure that pecking order.
Yeah.
You know, think about, you know, you see somebody, I don't know if you played sports, Dan. Mm-hmm. You see somebody on a football field that's got a little bit of, you know, limp to him. You know, you're probably going to run the ball at him, right?
Yep.
You're going to take advantage, and you're going to will yourself to take advantage through that scenario.
Yeah.
And that's the best analogy. We don't know what's going through the turkey's head, but I can tell you this, it's probably tied back to, I can take advantage of this. This person is hurt, or this turkey is hurt, just like we would take advantage of it. This person is injured or hurt.
Yeah.
And I can get the upper hand.
Gotcha. Okay. And I don't know. That's just something that's always been fascinating for me, is to watch that instinct, because that's kind of what it is, right? It's, you know.
Yeah, it's just a reaction.
A reaction. Yeah. Which is a pretty powerful reaction, right? You know, like, your buddy just got his head blown off, okay? And there's a very loud bang, and that I want to stomp on this guy's head is a stronger instinct than I think I should get away from this loud noise.
Yeah, you know, but that's probably us kind of putting some of our thoughts through it,
okay.
Right? You know, the turkeys are just instinctive.
Yeah.
Bang, noise went off, this guy fell down, I'm gonna do this. You know, they don't rationalize like, oh, I need to run away from that noise.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's hard to put yourself in their shoe and, you know, what they're doing, but they don't have that ability to think like that.
Right.
They're reactive, it's instinctive, and they're saying, man, that guy that always beats me up, I can now get the upper hand.
Yeah.
And that's probably what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. When it comes to hunting now, what's one thing from a biological standpoint or an environment or environmental standpoint that would be good for hunters to identify about maybe the turkey, the flock that they're hunting, or the turkey that are on their property, that would allow them to be more successful filling a turkey tag?
So I think we have gotten to a point around the country in which we have numerous, we expanded our opportunities. When our populations were going up, we expanded on the fringes of our population for opportunities. Or that we extended seasons earlier than probably we should have, and then we've extended seasons later than we probably should have.
Mm-hmm.
To maximize opportunities, because the populations were going up, expanding, and we got, you know, kind of wanted those opportunities for hunters to experience turkey hunting. But what that's done is, tactically, it changes the way you hunt a little bit. Earlier in the seasons, you know, you can become more aggressive and utilize male decoys, because those birds are seeing that, and it's a very visceral reaction of I've got to be aggressive to him because he's trying to become more aggressive to me. That's why strutting decoys and male decoys work better earlier on, is because these birds are still in the process of trying to establish dominance within the population. And so as you progress through the season, that works less and less.
Yeah.
You know, so understanding where they're at with this. Now, you know, there's a lot of conversations about the use of male decoys, the jakes and strutters and all of this stuff, because it violates a lot of what we considered the code of conduct for wild turkeys, because of your mimicking or you're concealing yourself with the use of these. Now it's a violation of, you know, not wearing red, white, and blue and looking like a turkey. So it's kind of a cultural clash right now, right? You got the old traditional turkey hunters that are saying, no, I want to be at the base of a tree and I'm going to call my bird to me, versus trying to be more aggressive with these, you know, tom decoys and jake decoys. I mean, I remember growing up that the thought of using a gobble to get a bird to gobble back at you was frowned upon.
Really?
You know, wow. Yeah, I mean, that is not something. I mean, I remember when the first gobble calls were made, and it was like, oh, wow, this is really unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
And so understanding that role, kind of how that structure is, but then also understanding the timing and the life cycle of the hen is really important to really maximize your hunting opportunity and to increase your harvest within the regulations. Is I hunt a lot of middays, you know, because what happens is the birds that are just sitting on the net or not sitting on the nest yet, they're going to fly down. They're roosted with the bird, right? Mm-hmm. With the tom or around the tom. The tom flies down. She then flies down. She walks over to him and she hangs out with him for the morning. Mm-hmm. Right. She then will, at some point during that time, if she's nesting and receptive to breeding, she will wander off and go lay her egg. And then all of a sudden that tom goes, he's looking around and going, well, where'd she go? So he starts gobbling because he's wanting to attract the females again. Mm-hmm. And so that mid-morning to mid-afternoon is really a good time to hunt when you have birds that are actively laying eggs. And so then the other peak is if you have nest initiation that occurs here in South Carolina, it's about April 10th. That's when the majority of the hens have initiated their nests, is April the 10th. Add 10 days to that for 10 eggs per clutch. Then April 20th, most hens are going to be sitting on the nest and not even roosting with those birds.
Yeah.
And so then you can go and get access and find a bird on the roost and you can get close to him. And then you can go, because you're receptive, he's coming to you pretty quick because he's like, man, nobody's around.
Right.
But early in the season, lots of hens, none of them are doing nest initiating, and they're all just hanging out as a flock. Yep. Those are really tough hunting. That's why we've introduced and why people utilize, you know, most of the time strutter decoys or jake decoys, because they're taking advantage of the bird seeing that rival and going towards it to establish a pecking order.
Okay. Interesting. Let's see. We got about 12 minutes left.
Okay.
I want to talk a little bit about what is the biggest threat to wild turkey? Because, man, I remember, I want to say 7 to 10 years ago, I'd sit on a ridge, you know, sun's just coming up. You hit that call and it's just a waterfall of gobbles. I mean, a chain reaction all the way. One gobble starts another one, starts another one, starts another one. And you just hear all of them, right? You know, 5 years ago, I'm in the woods, same ridge. Man, what happened? There's no. So you start to hear turkey hunters throughout the nation talk about a decline in numbers. right? And mm-hmm. whether this is scientific based or whether this is just hunters talking amongst themselves, you hear things like habitat loss. You hear things like predator, nest predators. You hear things like mites that go on to the, you know, in the eyes and cause them to go blind or whatever. And then you also just sickness and disease. What is the biggest threat to the North American wild turkey?
Oh, we could probably go a lot longer than 12 minutes for this one. But it's a great question because, you know, we have seen a decline in the wild turkey population in some regions of the country. We've seen the wild turkey population become unstable. Mm-hmm. And we get and unstable doesn't mean that it's crashing. It just means one year it's up, one year it's down. You know, we used to be on a steady increase. I mean, it was just always just going up. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of plateaued. And so now we're kind of just kind of wavering. You know, sometimes it's down, sometimes it's up, and we're doing these things through state agencies' efforts and brood surveys. But what's occurring now is we're not seeing poults created at the same pace and recruited into the population like they used to be. Mm-hmm. Now, we're trying to understand what's causing that. And I'll give you an example. We're now seeing where populations, hens are seeing less than two poults per hen on average are getting recruited into the population. That number, that two poults per hen, if you can get to two and somewhere real a little bit above two, that means your population is going to be stable. Okay. Then you start to say, okay, if you can get to three, your population is going to be increasing. But if you're below two, you're losing ground as a turkey population. And so when we were seeing the increases, we were seeing three and a half poults per hen, high recruitment. But something has changed across the landscape. And it's probably a little sliver of all of those things you talked about.
Gotcha.
Do turkeys get eaten? Yes, they are a prey species. They are a prey-based species. They are meant to be eaten. Mm-hmm. That's what they've evolved to be done.
And that is why, and this is my education that I've gotten from National Geographics, that's why prey animals tend to have way more, whether it's chicks or fish, you know, they have hundreds. Fish have hundreds, but that's because a big majority of them are eaten. Turkeys have large numbers because, you know, birth survival is really low.
Very low.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so something has happened with the timing of the breeding seasons, and we don't really know what's causing this, but we're starting to see an elongation of nesting attempts where they happen over a longer period of time. And so that means that if you only have a finite number of hens that are nesting and they're no longer synchronized in a very tight window, we're not saturating the habitat for predators to survive predation. So that's one potential cause, is that the elongated nesting season is longer. It's longer now than it historically was.
Okay.
And so it's a bell curve, right? You know, we want that real tight bell curve in biology. What we're starting to see is that we're getting larger shoulders on the front end and on the back end, which means we're just spreading out that nesting attempts across the landscape. You couple that with increased, you know, predators on the landscape. Mm-hmm.